Under governor's orders, restrictions on businesses lift bit by bit, but can Texas really be a little bit open for business? A snapshot of how it's playing out today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Reporters from across the state on how and whether the incremental reopening is taking hold. Also, floating storage facilities start crowding parts of the Gulf Coast offshore. We'll hear why. Also, the first graduates of the new medical school in the RGV enter a brave new world. And something's going missing in Texas, namely the difference between certain vowels. The latest Texan translation and a whole lot more as the Texas Standard gets underway on this Monday, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 11th day of May, 2020. Happy Monday, one and all, and it's great to have you with us. Hope your weekend was a good one. Hey, does anyone remember, maybe it was back when you were in middle school, the concept first smacked you upside the face. When it comes to some things, you can't be a little bit. You can't be a little bit finished with your homework. You can't be a little bit lactose intolerant. You can't be a little bit pregnant. No, in some endeavors in human affairs, it is all or nothing at all. It either is, or as they say outside of public radio, it ain't. As we enter what is by some estimates either the 8th week of mass quasi-quarantine or the 2nd week of Texas's coming out of lockdown, it's worth asking whether it really is doable to have a little bit of reopening and what that plus a little bit of stay-at-home actually adds up to. Governor Abbott's incremental reopening strategy is aimed at getting Texas back to business in phases, which on one level sounds reasonable, but as a practical matter is proving fraught with certain problems. For instance, many businesses would love to reopen, but placing limits on the numbers of customers they can serve makes it difficult to reopen at all. Then there's the issue of workers who may want to return to work or may not feel it's safe or economically sensible to do so, to say nothing of the possibility that trying to do so might give a pandemic a certain grand reopening too. On this Monday, we're looking at the state of the reopening in Texas with three reporters from different phases and places across Texas. Matt Largy is the project's editor at our home station KUT 90.5 in Austin, Texas. Matt, hello there.
Hello.
Sandra Sanchez is the South Texas correspondent for NextStarsBorderReport.com. She's in McAllen this morning. Sandra, welcome.
Good morning.
And Caitlin Bain is the government reporter for the Beaumont Enterprise out in Southeast Texas. Caitlin, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Matt, let's start with you in the Texas capital city. Austin and Travis County leaders extending their stay-at-home order as hair and nail salons got green light to partially reopen this weekend. How is that working out?
Yeah, so they're extending basically what was already in place, with the exception of the salons and the barbershops and all that. And they're extending it through the end of the month. They say they're seeing this as sort of a yellow light phase. They really want to get a sense of how things are going in terms of the numbers, in terms of the numbers of infections, and whether or not the number of cases is rising because of an increase in interactions between people. And so they're kind of in a wait-and-see mode. So they're still requiring people to wear face masks in public, and they're still banning social gatherings. But, of course, it's all voluntary because there's no enforcement mechanism really for it.
So have you heard anything about how the hair salons, nail salons did over the weekend, or is it just a little bit too early to know?
I've heard, anecdotally anyway, I've heard that a lot of salons are not reopening or have not reopened because they're also in this sort of wait and see approach. I know somebody who runs a hair salon and she wasn't ready to reopen at this point.
Was that because she was concerned about safety, or was it just didn't make any economic sense given the number of customers you could serve?
A little bit of both, actually. I mean, she's concerned about the safety of reopening, but then also worried about what happens if in 2 or 3 weeks she's forced to shut down again because there's a rise in cases.
Yeah. Sandra, I want to bring you in here. You're down in McAllen. I know you cover all that border region in South Texas. Cities like Laredo say they're going to issue citations for people who don't wear face coverings in public. How does that square with what Governor Abbott has said about enforcement?
Yes, actually, Laredo has continued to issue citations. However, they're not collecting any fines. The border communities on the border with Mexico are very vulnerable, and local leaders have continued to regulate policies that require face masks and social distancing, and they're not allowing groups over 10 to congregate. It's because of Mexico, Tamaulipas, which is 6 miles from where I am right now, has yet to hit its peak. And there are, wide speculation that Mexico has not been reporting the number of cases or deaths as they should. The state of Tamaulipas has 200 border miles with us, and they're only saying that they have 828 cases and 46 deaths, and it's been rising incrementally every day by about 20 cases. So leaders who operate, who run cities on these borders, Laredo, which is across from Nuevo Laredo, McAllen across from Reynosa, Brownsville across from Matamoros, are extremely concerned about what's coming over the bridges. And we're hearing anecdotally that the bridge wait times are very long. This weekend, they were 2 to 5 hours for Mother's Day, although non-essential travel is supposed to still be banned from crossing at the ports of entry.
Boy, that is really interesting. You have a lot of people down in deep South Texas who are economically on the edge. I mean, this has hit them especially hard. And I know that there must be a lot of pressure to reopen. Are you seeing many reopenings down along the border, or are people trying to hold off because of the concerns about what's happening with the rise in Mexico?
Actually, starting midweek last week, I saw a tremendous amount of traffic. It had really been like a ghost town for several weeks. People took this very seriously, face masks everywhere. And then starting Thursday, it was as if everyone was out shopping for Mother's Day gifts, which is, local
Interesting.
leaders say, very scary because, and this is a predominantly Hispanic area. It is very low income, and everyone, it's very cultural. We have ties to both sides of the Rio Grande. And, it was very expected that people were going to visit family for Mother's Day, although leaders kept warning, if you love your mother, please don't visit or hug her on Mother's Day. So we'll see in a couple weeks how that played out. We are expecting an increase in cases here because of this past weekend.
Let's head on out to Southeast Texas, Golden Triangle, part of Texas. Caitlin, you write that some coronavirus testing in Port Arthur is winding down. How are people taking that amid the number of cases there? What are you hearing?
Yeah, so we have had this 6-county task force of Southeast Texas counties that banded together at the start of this to be able to roll out testing in kind of a systematic way instead of just having testing through private providers. They last week announced that in the middle of this month would be shutting down all of their testing sites and giving control back over to cities and private groups. However, the city of Port Arthur, which is 69% Black and Latino, so does have quite a few of these residents that studies have shown tend to be at higher risk of contracting or having complications of this virus, hasn't been able to get a testing program in place yet and hasn't seen the number of people tested that some of our other area cities have. The mayor says that's because it just hasn't been economically viable or interesting for residents to make the trip to get tested, then potentially have to stay home from work. So they just haven't gotten tested. But when we had a one-day testing site out in Port Arthur last week, more testing happened there than any other one-day site. So it's been kind of a mixed reaction from some of our more affluent residents are very excited. They're getting back to work. I've seen them posting on Facebook for weeks that we shouldn't be shut down anyways, and why do we need to keep testing? And then the mayor of Port Arthur, on the other hand, is very concerned, has been calling on the county judges to reverse their course, quite frankly, calling on the governor to reverse his course, because he's worried about what this means for his city moving forward.
Boy, you anticipated what I was going to ask everyone there, and I'll just y'all jump in as you see fit. We just heard about this challenge to the governor's orders. What are local leaders saying in general, that economies are being hit too hard, or do they welcome more stay at home? What's the overall sense? Jump in and just identify yourself if you would.
Well, this is Sandra. In South Texas, the leaders just don't think reopening is reflective of what should be happening at this time because we are so close to Mexico. As I mentioned earlier, Laredo went ahead and said, no, we're going to continue to require face masks. And they still have a curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. And they were, the initial days, issuing citations with fines, and then they kind of walked that back and said, well, we're not going to collect the money. But it's a symbolic gesture because they want to scare people, residents, enough to know that don't go out, stay inside.
Matt, you did a story last week talking about going back into public pools, which I guess can now be what, open under this phase two of the governor's orders, right?
That's right. Yeah. But this, at least here in Austin, the city has said that they're not ready to do anything like that. And they're going to wait and develop a plan where they can reopen them safely. I mean, city leaders here have been, it seems like they've been careful not to directly confront or criticize Abbott for reopening. But at the same time, they very clearly would rather be staying in a stay-at-home mode.
That's the voice of Matt Largy. He's projects editor at a home station, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Sandra Sanchez is South Texas correspondent for Nexstar's BorderReport.com, and she's been talking to us from McAllen. Caitlin Bain is the government reporter for the Beaumont Enterprise. She covers the Golden Triangle and beyond. Y'all, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, but he's away today, so we're joined now by Michael Marks. Hello there, Michael.
David, as we just heard there, reporters from across Texas talking to us about phase two of Governor Abbott's plan to reopen the state. Before the show, I asked on the Texas Standard Facebook page and Twitter feed whether folks were going to go out. Got quite a few responses, including this one from Melinda LaRue Marshall, who apparently did not go out. She writes, I will not change my stay-at-home plans until we have falling numbers of new cases of the virus in the Dallas area for 2 weeks and better access to testing, higher numbers of people being tested. Not everyone following this course of action, though. We also got this message from Jamie Fisher, who says in part, we are choosing to stay home. We live on the Gulf Coast, and you would have thought it was Memorial Day weekend here. Bumper-to-bumper traffic. Out-of-town tourists headed to the beach.
That's amazing. I don't know if you heard about Mark Cuban sending out some of his workers to find out how things are shaking out in the Dallas region. We'll probably have more on that and a whole lot more from you, Texas. Just look for us, Texas Standard, on your social media platform of choice. Michael Marks looking for you. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As we mentioned a little earlier, Texas salons finally joined restaurants and movie theaters in reopening on Friday, promising safety and cleaning protocols that will both limit profits but perhaps enhance customers' willingness to go out to the salon. KACU's Heather Claiborne went out to Brownwood to get a sense of how the reopening was playing out and maybe get something else, too.
I feel like it's safe to blow dry right now. There's no one around us. Are you okay with it?
I was Jessica Hicks' first official client when she reopened her salon Friday.
Did you miss this part?
She'd canceled my last appointment in mid-March because she has an infant at home and wanted to prioritize safety.
That's probably when I stopped because I canceled that one. So then it would have been February 14th. Yeah, that's when it was. Because March 19th, we canceled you. Yep. So gosh, I haven't worked in almost 2 months.
I never got desperate enough to try to trim my own short hair, but I nervously updated my highlights about a month ago.
I don't know if it's like that for all women, but for me, it's a confidence booster.
Lindsay Owen drove 80 minutes from Abilene and may have been even more excited to see Jessica than I was.
My husband took my extensions out for me about 2 weeks ago. With some pliers. So, yeah, with some pliers. Had some little pliers, but it was fine.
It was a bit quieter than usual inside the basement salon on Friday. There were just a few stylists and clients. In the waiting area, the modern chairs and faux leather love seat sat empty around a bare farmhouse coffee table. And the mimosas and coffee bar are gone.
And we had to move all magazines, anything you could touch, our waiting area. They don't want anyone sitting in the waiting area. That's why we can't do drinks. Like, as much cross-contamination that we can stop, we're going to try.
Those are a couple of the rules they got from the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation. They also have a list of recommendations, like not accepting walk-in clients or using hair dryers. Overall, Hicks says she's not worried about reopening. She says especially because most of Brownwood's cases are in local nursing homes.
It feels a little ridiculous to me, but if it makes my clients feel better, I'm going to do it.
And Lindsay Owen says she and her husband are being very careful about going out, getting takeout or curbside delivery in Abilene. And those guidelines do make her feel more comfortable.
I'm not worried, but I'm definitely cautious.
You weren't nervous to come to the salon?
No. I knew there was guidelines, and I feel like it's not going to be ever so crowded in here.
Out of 8 stylists, only 3 had clients first thing Friday morning. Hicks says her other stylists will get back to work this week. Amid the snips and shampooing and packs of extensions, the chatter revolved around COVID-19, wearing masks, Zoom calls with teachers, missing restaurants, and how surprised the stylists were that Governor Abbott allowed salons to reopen so quickly.
My phone just started blowing up with text messages of clients trying to get in and sending me messages saying that we're open Friday, and this was on Tuesday, so it was very sudden, and we had just heard it was going to be June 1st, so I was not prepared.
But she was excited. Hicks applied for a Paycheck Protection Program loan, but the salon didn't qualify since her staff is considered self-employed.
And we did get disaster unemployment, but some girls are just now getting it. So, like, we applied when we got closed down, and no one's really gotten paid until, like, a week ago.
But it's going to take Hicks and her staff a while to catch up financially. Hicks says they usually double book clients, but that's against the rules, too. She says it'll now take her 8 hours to earn what she used to make in 4. But she's just glad to be back at work. I'm Heather Claiborne in Brownwood.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. One of the issues driving the oil market meltdown amid the coronavirus pandemic, where do we put all the stuff? As demand plummeted, the oil glut that was already a problem before the pandemic hit became even worse. Storage space is running short, and dozens of oil tankers have dropped their anchors near ports worldwide. So what can they tell us about the state of the industry? Here with some insight, Energy Insider Matt Smith. He's Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data, and he joins us bi-weekly. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
What are some of the key indicators to look at when it comes to these oil tankers to see if things are improving or not?
Sure. You hit on it there, David, in terms of the floating storage. So that's one key metric that we follow to gauge the health of the global oil market. And as prices have plunged over the last few months, as demand has cratered, we've seen that floating storage rising. It's been increasing off of Singapore, which is what you'd kind of expect because that's the parking lot of Asia. You essentially have these unsold cargoes that go there and wait for a buyer. But we've also seen it rising off of less usual places. So off of Europe, off of Latin America, off of Africa, and it's hit a record in recent days of 170 million barrels.
Can I ask you about this concept of floating storage, which I think will strike some people as novel, people who don't know much about the industry? How common is it?
The U.S. Gulf is probably a good example. Hmm. You see vessels waiting outside there simply because there's a lot of crude that's coming in every day. And so you can see these vessels waiting typically, you know, for a number of days. But floating storage is really classified, at least by us and by other members of the industry, as something that has waited there for 7 days or longer.
Interesting. Now, you brought up the Gulf, of course. Anything mm-hmm. interesting that you've noticed is specifically there in the Gulf Coast around Texas?
Yeah. So there's going to be, because we've got 15 VLCCs. VLCC stands for Very Large Crude Carrier. Uh-huh. And these are heading to the U.S. Gulf. Well, they're either in the U.S. Gulf or heading there, 15 of these VLCCs, by the end of this month. And they're each carrying 2 million barrels. And so what's happened is you've had Saudi Arabia launching this price war, and these cargoes were booked a couple of months ago, and they're all arriving in the next few weeks. And so you're going to be seeing those building up in the U.S. Gulf there, just because there's kind of there'll be a logjam to try and bring them on shore. So
does this create some other problems, like concerns for the environment or concerns about I just didn't know whether there's any kind of practical consideration other than the fact that you've got a bunch of ships sitting right off the coast of Texas?
Well, the U.S. has been a much larger importer than it is now. You know, back sort of 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, when the U.S. wasn't as large a producer, they used to import a lot more. And so the U.S. Gulf is able to deal with this amount of crude coming in. But I think this is also a demand side issue as well. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we see with the U.S. West Coast, we've seen vessels building up offshore there as well. And the reason for that is because these refineries are just not running because there's not the demand for the underlying products they produce, the gasoline and the diesel. And so you're seeing them building up offshore because of demand concerns as opposed to any supply kind of issue.
So what do all these oil movements tell us about the global impact of coronavirus?
Well, China is getting back up and running. Their imports could well hit a record this month as their refining activity rebounds amid stronger domestic demand. The U.S. is starting to emerge from lockdown, hence we're seeing oil imports increasing into the U.S. Gulf Coast, the East Coast, the West Coasts. But Latin America is currently at its worst point in terms of the virus. And so we're seeing a buildup of clean products offshore. Mexico, Ecuador, there just isn't product demand in these countries amid the lockdowns and quarantines. And so it's really just this wave of demand impacts across the world.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, thanks for getting us back up to speed.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. El Paso officials are working to contain a recent spike in COVID-19 cases and fatalities with help from the governor's rapid response team. El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar says the disease has disproportionately impacted Latino populations, such as her hometowns. On NPR's Morning Edition today, the Democrat said lower incomes and lack of health care overall make the group as vulnerable as nursing home residents.
We've got to approach communities like El Paso and other minority communities with the same sense of urgency for tracing and testing, because the pandemic can explode in communities like ours more significantly.
Escobar said Latinos account for 27% of COVID-19 deaths nationwide, but make up 18% of the population. Industry experts predict more oil and gas companies will declare bankruptcy in the coming months. Houston Public Media's Kyra Buckley reports the pandemic and a global oversupply of oil continue to keep prices low.
So low that companies are reporting billions in losses, slashing budgets, and laying off workers. Charlie Beckham specializes in oil and gas bankruptcies at the firm Haynes & Boone. He says companies may not be making enough to pay off their debt.
Filing Chapter 11 allows them to at least put on hold the payment of some of those obligations, such as interest and trade creditor debt, while they try to rearrange their balance sheet and right-size their balance sheet.
Beckham says when companies took on a lot of that debt, they expected oil to reach $70 a barrel or more. Instead, prices are at historic lows, even going negative one day last month. I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo says he's retiring the badge number of a fallen officer. 35-year-old Jason Knox died on May 2nd when his HPD helicopter crashed while searching for possible drowning victims in a bayou. During a funeral service Saturday, Acevedo spoke of saving the life of a Harris County Sheriff's deputy who had been swept away in floodwaters during Tropical Storm Imelda.
And was clinging to life and was barely hanging on. And we were losing hope. And all of a sudden, Jason Michael Knox, from whatever feet he was at, spotted that deputy, and we were able to bring in boats to rescue him, and he saved a life.
Texas leads the nation in line-of-duty deaths in 2020 with 9. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Bite-Away, a chemical-free treatment alternative to instantly relieve the itch and pain caused by insect bites. Portable, reusable, and no mess. Suitable for children. Learn more at TakeTheBiteAway.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. For as long as most folks can remember, there's been a huge need for doctors in the Rio Grande Valley. One way to attract physicians is to have a medical school in the area. Since the 1940s, the Rio Grande Valley has been asking for just such a thing. And back in 1997, Senate Bill 606 greenlit the groundwork for such a medical school. Well, on Saturday, amid a health crisis, the scale of which the world has never seen, those first students graduated from med school.
I am Dr. John Krause, the Dean of the UTRGV School of Medicine, and I present to you our charter graduating class of 2020.
I am Veronica Trevino. I'm 25, so I'm definitely younger than the class average. It's taken 70 plus years to be able to have a medical school in the Valley. We're making part of history with the school.
Hello, I am Ramiro Tobar III. I always knew that I wanted to practice medicine here in the Valley.
My name is Jo Alvarado. My mom cannot wait to call me Dr. Joy. I am also a second lieutenant in the military in the U.S. Army, and I will be promoted to captain as soon as residency starts. The medical field can be very sad, but having a doctor bring joy into a room, I think, is great. That's exactly what people need.
My name is Sean Azadi. When I was at the University of Texas, you know, I came in as a saxophone player. I joined the marching band. And football was always my pastime. I played in high school. You know, fast forward, I graduated doing both. I marched at halftime in my my pads.
The area that we're in is a very underserved area. Just your zip code can determine how long you're going to live. Even if they're next to each other, you can have a difference in life expectancies of up to 10 years.
Exactly, and I grew up here. I was born and raised in the Valley, and I had no idea the kinds of disparities. We're talking muddy roads. These people, when it rains, they can't leave their houses because there's miles of mud. They don't have access to clean water.
Our school is next to many of these colonias, and our student team created a student-run clinic, a health clinic in Penitas, Texas.
Medical school, up until this point, has kind of been the hardest trial and test of my life. It isn't, I think, until lots of medical students really interact with their first true life patient where they realize that, you know, this process is worth it and, you know, there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
It was my second rotation in third year. We were working tremendous hours. You know, sometimes you're going in at 4 in the morning, you're not leaving till 10 because the surgery goes late, or 11. It just becomes so difficult to be able to, like, even stand, you know, when you're sleep deprived, when you're food deprived. But I remember in particular one very late surgery. One thing, most surgeons like to play music when they're operating. I was having that little panic attack, and this song, you know, Living on a Prayer, that song actually came out, and that's my fiance's favorite song. And, you know, the lyrics really stuck out to me, you know, like, oh, you know, we're halfway there, you know, living on a prayer, and like, just thinking about her, thinking about, you know, like, you know, I really want to do this. This is my passion. You know, it gave me a second wind. I felt myself reach my limit, and I felt myself go past it.
At the end of my career, I want to look back and really feel that I helped my patients feel connected, feel safe, feel secure. I can say that I've really formed a bond with my community and that I've given them a safe haven.
Every generation has some kind of plight or struggle that they had to go through, some marker. And this might be our marker. You know, we're going into residency having to combat this virus. I think when we think of metaphors of war, it's not necessarily comparing the tragedy and the gore and things like that. It's much more about everybody creating a united fight against this offender that has deadly consequences, you know, and I think that's a beautiful idea that we can all get together and support each other in this.
Am I scared? Absolutely. But am I enthusiastic and am I excited to go and help these people that are already in the battlefront? 100%. We are the class of 2020.
We are the first graduating class of the UTRGV School of Medicine.
Really, I think what we need to do is be very honest about what we don't know and to say what we do know based on the evidence that's available. And I think that can be a challenge, but I think the medical profession needs and owes it to its patients to address these issues in that way.
The voices of Dr. John Krause, Dean of UTRGV's School of Medicine, and Drs. Ramiro Tovar III, Sean Izzati, Joy Alvarado, and Veronica Trevino. Congratulations, graduates.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Sales tax revenues dropped sharply during the pandemic, shrinking city budgets and forcing hard decisions about government workforces. The city of Dallas has announced it'll furlough 472 staffers because of the pandemic-induced budget crunch. KERA's Bill Zeeble reports on where the pinch will be felt the hardest.
While the furloughs affect fewer than 4% of the city's 13,000 workers, they include more than a quarter of the 900 parks and recreation staffers, nearly half the 400 library workers, and the Office of Arts and Culture alone will lose 32 of its 60 employees. The furloughs of employees deemed non-essential were announced on Friday and will last at least through the end of July. In a memo, City Manager T.C. Broadnack said the city faces a $25 million budget shortfall this fiscal year, and that could rise to as much as $134 million in the next fiscal year. City spokesperson Catherine Cuellar, the former executive director of the Dallas Arts District, blamed plummeting tax revenues forced by a rising COVID-19.
A furlough is a very difficult decision to make. The city was focused on protecting core services and essential civilian employees, both in the field and working from home.
Cuellar said the furloughs will save the city $4 million. Vicky Meek, a former city employee who now sits on the Arts and Culture Advisory Commission, says artists often revive down economies and residents through their performances. Eventually, she says, that might happen again, but she doesn't know when.
I've lived through two furloughs, but this is looking like the worst that we ever had to endure. This is something that has affected every single method of getting money that we have, and I just don't feel like it's going to be an easy return.
City Manager Broadnax is working on a return-to-work plan expected to be unveiled this week. Meanwhile, furloughed city workers will be eligible for unemployment benefits through federal COVID-19 relief funding for the length of their furloughs. Those who signed up for health insurance will have coverage extended through July. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
And it's time once again for a segment we call
Texan.
Translation.
wherein we explore the state's linguistic landscape with Lars Henricks. He is a professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin and the director of the Texas English Linguistics Lab. Professor, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
So I understand that today we are going to be talking about two different words that may or may not sound the same. Tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, that's right. So we're talking about caught, as in the thing you sleep on, and caught, as in I caught a fish.
Okay. I gather in linguistics there's a term for this, a caught-caught merger. Is that right?
Yes. And the way you just said it, you clearly do not have the merger. They sound very different when you say them.
Interesting. What is it? When you say merger, you're talking about the pronunciation, clearly. It's not just the words caught and caught. You hear the merger in pairs like one dons a cap and the break of dawn, right?
Don and dawn, yes. Pond, P-O-N-D, or I pawned some jewelry. So, yeah, it's about the vowel sounds. English has about 15, 16 classes of different vowels. But these two, they're historically different classes of vowels, but they're becoming the same in many parts of North America. For example, the South, mm-hmm. and certainly Texas, many people still distinguish between caught and caught, but most younger people don't. Huh. And so, yes, we're looking for an example from an older Texan speaker who clearly has these two vowels as different vowels, and we found a great example in recordings of Lady Bird Johnson. This is from the LBJ Library, and this is Lady Bird Johnson reading from her diaries. First she says caught, and then caught, C-O-T.
Lyndon apparently had caught a cold. Something like 37 nights when Lyndon had spent on a cot in the Capitol.
You hear the difference? Those are completely different words for her.
Caught.
I do hear the difference, but you're saying that caught distinction is going away.
Exactly, yes. To illustrate that, we have an example from a modern Texan who you know very well, David. He's going to introduce himself, and then you'll hear him say the two words we've been listening to.
My name is Casey Cheek. I am the technical director for the Texas Standard. I grew up in Abilene, Texas, and here are the words. Caught. I don't think they sound any different, but.
that's really interesting. So Lady Bird's pronunciation of these two words in 64 was completely different, clearly. Casey's pronunciation in 2020 was exactly the same. I guess the question is, what's driving this change?
That's a really tough question for a linguist. So we're losing the distinction between two vowel sounds, but that's not too big of a cost. The English language still works fine, even if you have the merger. But where does it come from? It's possible. This is one theory. Canada is completely merged, and we know that Americans have always thought Canadian English is kind of a model of North American English. So many newscasters and famous TV anchors come from Canada. Maybe that's the source of merging in those parts of the U.S. that have it. And yeah, Texas among the young people is now certainly one of those places.
What about across Texas? Is this happening sort of at a similar rate in Texas, or do you see little pockets where there's an embrace of the merger and a rejection thereof?
Yeah, there's an age dimension where the young people have the merger more than the older people, and there's a rural-urban dimension where the urban places have it more than rural places. So it's worth stressing, though, that the merger isn't happening uniformly. There are still plenty of people who are unmerged, even some in urban environments. Here's an example.
I'm Shelley Brisbane. I am web editor and a segment producer at Texas Standard. I grew up in Austin, Texas. Caught. Dawn. Dawn is my middle name, by the way, so clearly whatever way I say it would be the right one.
That's a colleague, Shelley Brisbane, here at Texas Standard.
She's clearly like an intermediate stage because the caught pair was very different, but the Dawn pair wasn't.
You think we're going to get to a point where everyone's pronunciation is merged when it comes to these vowel sounds?
Well, in an area such as Texas, where the merger is pretty far advanced already, I think so, yes. It'll keep changing. If you spend 5 minutes in England, for example, you will notice that the merger is not going to come there anytime soon. So I think merged versus unmerged regions are going to continue to coexist in the English-speaking world.
All right, Texas, are your COT and COTS merged or unmerged? Let us hear from you on Twitter, Facebook, or shoot us an email at texasstandard.org. Lars Henriks can be caught at the University of Texas at Austin. Did you get that? He's a professor of English there, and he's director of the Texas English Linguistics Lab. Professor Henriks, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The number of COVID-19 cases in Texas continues to rise as more businesses begin to open, but essential workers have been on the job for weeks now, and labor advocates say a lack of protection for these employees early on could mean more risk as more people come back to work. Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Leanos Jr. talked to workers at a shipyard in Brownsville who worry what further reopening of the state could mean for them.
It's Wednesday, May 6, 5:20 a.m.
Alex Chavez heads to work at the port of Brownsville. The morning sun has not yet punched through the darkness. He's got his hard hat, lunchbox, and uniform shirt.
About to get in the car. Gonna have my wife take me. It's not like before where come to work and you're gonna have a great day, you're gonna have a good day. It's different this time because of this COVID-19. You still gotta be cautious when you're talking to people, how close you get to somebody, what you touch.
20 minutes later, Alex arrives at a shipyard called Keppel Amphils. He must wait in line before clocking into work.
So you go and then you see some tables that are about maybe 60 yards away. There's some tables there where they check your temperatures.
Workers wait in the pre-dawn haze to get their temperature checked. Then once inside,
me, I have a helper, and we get our tools ready. We connect the wires. We connect everything. The welding leads, the torch, everything we need, the extension cords. The whole day, we're working together side by side.
Alex says alongside other colleagues, they're building two ships, and social distancing has been difficult. It's hard work, and the job became even more difficult 3 weeks ago when employees received a company memo stating that someone at their worksite tested positive for COVID-19.
I was shocked about it, and I was just waiting for that type of news to happen.
Alex worries that the employee might have interacted closely with other people at the shipyard. Another worker, who didn't want his name revealed out of fear of retaliation, says the company started handing out masks a couple of days before the employees learned that someone had tested positive on the site.
They're not making it mandatory because they know that if they make it mandatory, they're going to stab themselves in the back because they know they don't have enough supplies.
That was about 3 weeks ago when I first spoke to him. Now, Alex says as of last week, the company made it mandatory to wear a mask. Still, the workers wonder if they'll be protected in the future.
There's a huge demand for information about employment rights right now, as you can imagine.
That's Catherine Euchre with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, and Congress have not passed any new federal laws that require companies to provide face masks to their employees or enforce social distancing during the pandemic. Euchre says OSHA hasn't come out with any enforceable emergency standards for coronavirus.
OSHA is the agency that's charged with creating standards and enforcing them. And unfortunately, they've decided not to do that during the pandemic.
Under existing OSHA standards, the employer must provide safeguards, such as personal protective equipment. However, the problem now is that there's limited oversight.
OSHA is only considering on-site inspections for fatalities and imminent danger exposures related to COVID-19, with particular attention given to healthcare organizations and first responders.
A public OSHA memo states companies who have had an employee file a complaint take matters into their own hands. It asks companies to conduct their own investigation because OSHA, quote, does not intend to conduct an on-site inspection at this time.
OSHA has chosen not to do any on-site investigations to protect its own workers.
We reached out to OSHA about the agency limiting its investigations and why it hasn't come out with any enforceable emergency standards for coronavirus, but we have not heard back. In the meantime, Alex will continue to clock in. He says he needs to put food on the table at home.
I'm going to think about a family, and it scares me every day when I walk into work because I pray that today, I hope I don't catch anything.
Keppel Amphils and Cameron County have not responded to our request for an interview. According to company memos provided to TPR by workers, there are now 4 confirmed COVID-19 cases at the company, with about a dozen others told to quarantine at home because they had been exposed to one of the 4 employees who tested positive for the virus. I'm Reynaldo Llanos Jr. in Mission.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. So Michael Marks is monitoring social media on this Monday. Michael, did you see this story over the weekend about Elon Musk, who got ticked off at Alameda County, California? They said that he couldn't reopen his Tesla plant, and so he fires off a tweet, as he sometimes does, and he said that he's going to file a lawsuit and examine moving the lawmaker to, quote, Texas/Nevada. Nevada, I should say. And apparently he's made good on that first promise. He filed the lawsuit to get his plant reopened. But now there's a whole lot of talk about possibility. Of course, he has a Texas presence already, right? I mean, They've got the space efforts down there in near Brownsville, near the coast. I got a lot of people talking over the weekend, that's for sure.
I believe the start of that tweet that kicked things off, David, was, frankly, this is the final straw. If we even retain Fremont manufacturing activity at all, it will depend on how Tesla is treated in the future. Tesla, he notes, the last car maker in California. I saw quite a bit about that, David. Musk has been quite vocal about reopening the U.S. economy as quickly as possible. And to your point, you know, plenty of Texans backing Musk on social media in that regard. Have a couple here. This one is from Danny Vargas in Midlothian. That's in the DFW Metroplex. Mm-hmm. Danny Vargas tweets at Elon Musk, "Please move your headquarters to North Texas. I'd gladly work for you, sir. I'd leave my job and go work for you in a heartbeat." No clues as to what that job is. Likewise, in Caddo Mills, Richard Dobson requests that Musk bring the jobs, not the people. We got good people here that want to work. Hashtag Tesla to Texas.
Interesting because Toyota moved from California to Texas, and it's got this whole California-Texas dynamic going on here, too, which is kind of driving a lot of the commentary, I'm sure.
It really wasn't that long ago, David, when these were regular headlines, you know, of Texas poaching California businesses. You remember reading about, I believe there was a state representative who gave officials from the Sriracha company a tour.
That's right. That's right. The hot sauce.
They might be able to, yeah, exactly. And many, many others that flew under the radar. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised, as you alluded to, that Musk tweeted potential corporate moves. There was that whole business about taking the company private that raised some eyebrows at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Right. Well, this is certainly a watch this space kind of situation. See what he does.
Absolutely. And I suppose we should also mention very briefly that Mark Cuban hired a firm to do some secret shopping. And they called 1,000 businesses at first to find out how many were actually reopening. They finding only that 36% were actually allowing customers in, and more than half of them weren't following all the protocols. It's just a couple of the stories we continue to track here at the Texas Standard. We're out of time for the big broadcast. You can keep up with everything over at texasstandard.org. And we'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a marvelous Monday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare. The Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.